Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. This is the Damage Report, everybody. I am John Iadarola. We've got a great show for you, including a number of awesome guests. So momentarily, Shivala Madlina is going to be joining me in studio to co-host the entirety of the episode. She is perhaps most importantly my co-host from True North, my Arctic docuseries that was released earlier this year. She also, however, is an international documentarian and investigative journalist who's worked pretty much everywhere across the planet. And she's going to be joining me to break down a number of incredibly interesting stories, including some updates on Hurricane Florence and also responses to other hurricanes, including Donald Trump's statements about Hurricane Maria and the death toll there. That might be the craziest and most offensive thing that he has ever said, which is really saying something. We'll see if my co-host agrees with that. We've also got some updated numbers on the number of children currently being held near the border and throughout the country, the detained children. The number is far higher than we had previously believed. And we've also got some QAnon, some Dianne Feinstein and things like that. But we also have two awesome guests Skyping into the show. So first of all, in like 15 minutes, we've got David Sirota, who's going to be joining us to talk about the primaries, the battle to retake the House, but perhaps more importantly, to retake the soul of the Democratic Party. So we're going to be breaking down some of the primaries that have pitted progressive challengers against far more establishment corporate Democrats and the significance of some of those races. Then later on, Randy Weingarten, head of the American Federation of Teachers, is going to be joining us to talk about the strikes that have been going on, the teacher strikes, the walkouts across the country, how significant those have been and what they've been able to accomplish to improve the working conditions of teachers and also the conditions of our schools as well. So all of that and more coming up for you in this hour. But we're going to be starting off with the hurricanes. So Hurricane Florence continues its journey towards the coast. Now, there has been a little bit of what is, I think, understandably being interpreted as good news, although perhaps not as good as you might think, with the storm having been downgraded late last night to, at least at that point, a Category 2 storm, which means that the overall wind speeds are lower. But that does not mean that this is not going to be a catastrophe. It does not mean that you do not need to evacuate if the state or the federal government have been pushing for it in the area that you're in. And in fact, the National Hurricane Center tweeted this: do not focus on the wind speed category of Hurricane Florence. Life-threatening storm surge flooding, catastrophic flash flooding, and prolonged significant river flooding are still expected. And you can see there the areas that are considered likely to be hardest hit. Those storm surges are going to be horrific, even if the overall wind speed is a little bit lower. And look, I'm not a meteorologist or anything like that, but there are also some beliefs that the lower wind speed means that it might linger over particular areas for longer. And even though the wind speed is lower, it can still do quite a bit of damage during that time. So if you have been told to leave the area, please do so. We had a talk with Jared Jackson on the show yesterday about the people who choose to wait out these storms. And there's at least two categories of that. Understandable people who don't have the resources to leave, who need help in leaving the area, and those who simply choose not to go. And I saw an interview with a woman who said that because some of her family and friends were also not leaving, she was going to stay and they would beat this hurricane using strength in numbers. That doesn't work. There's no strength in numbers against hurricanes. The hurricane does not care if there's a family bond or a group of friends. Get out if you can get out. It does a great deal of damage. And my fear is that people will die, and including people who did not need to, who might have been able to get out had they chosen to earlier. So please do so. Now, that said, while Hurricane Florence is still coming, we are still dealing with some of the fallout from Hurricane Maria. And thankfully, although it took forever, the media, you can come in, the media took a long time to take seriously how much damage actually was done to Puerto Rico in that hurricane last year and how many lives were actually taken. The official death count stood at 64 month after month after month, even though we knew relatively early on that far more people had been killed both in the storm and in the immediate aftermath of that storm. And now multiple reports, including both the US government, Puerto Rico's internal review, and external analysis, including by Harvard University, say that somewhere around 3,000 people died in the storm and because of the storm. So we know that now. That is a settled fact. except not when it comes to the president of the United States, who, despite the fact that his own government has helped generate those numbers, does not believe that they are remotely true. This might seem absurd, but he tweeted this morning. 3,000 people did not die in the two hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico when I left the island after the storm had hit. They had anywhere from 6 to 18 deaths. As time went by, it did not go up by much. Then, a long time later, they started to report really large numbers, like 3,000. This was done by the Democrats in order to make me look as bad as possible when I was successfully raising billions of dollars to help rebuild Puerto Rico. If a person died for any reason, like old age, just add them on the list. Bad politics. I love Puerto Rico. So Shivala Madlina joins me in studio now. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
The president does not believe that these numbers are accurate. He thinks that just anybody who died for any reason was able to successfully fool Harvard and Puerto Rico's government, which fought this higher number coming out for a long time, but it was just a political plot to make him look bad. What do you think?
First of all, going back to his tweet, what was this about raising billions of dollars to rebuild Puerto Rico?
Because in his mind, he did not ignore the tragedy month after month, refusing to actually produce the resources needed to stop people from dying. He instead was raising tons of money.
Right. So is it a tragedy that requires billions of dollars to rebuild, or did nothing happen? Like, it just a few people died. Uh-huh. I don't understand.
What did we need the billions for?
Yeah, I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I'm genuinely asking. But why am I doing that? Because we're taking things as if he's a good faith actor. Listen, even during Hurricane Katrina, there was still not like just an abject denial of death tolls. I mean, there was tussling over, and people tried to keep things. I mean, certainly you had the Bush administration over Iraq death tolls and things like that. We don't do body counts.
Yeah, that's true.
But I mean, and this is just the same thing. It's just, I don't know why he thinks that reality doesn't exist, though. I'll never understand that.
Or that, I mean, there are some people, like some sociopaths only see things through their own lens, and they think that the world only exists insofar as they experience it, and it's all about them. Basically, causality works in regards to them. So those people could not have died because that would make him look bad, and so they didn't die. And the people who are saying that they died could only be doing it to hurt him. Everything is in relation to him. He's said a lot of absurd things, a lot of horrendous and offensive things over time. But coming out and saying, you have been lied to, thousands did not die, we don't have any lessons to learn, we don't have to do better next time because we aced it last time, ignore all of objective reality and all of that, this didn't happen, is right up there at the top of the list. Because now, it doesn't matter what I say or what Shivala says. It doesn't matter, you know, the mayor of San Juan said that he was delusional, paranoid, and unhinged from any sense of reality. Trump is so vain that he thinks it's about him. No, it is not. Well, thank you, Carmen. But it doesn't matter. Something like 20 to 30% of the country will never accept those numbers now. Those 3,000 numbers, forget about that. For a third of the country, they don't exist. They're not accurate.
Well, I'm just curious to see. There's going to be another. I mean, there's a hurricane coming off the coast of mainland, and that's Trump territory as well. Mm-hmm. And so are numbers not going to be real when they hit, you know, the Carolinas? I'm just curious to see how he handles objective. I don't know how much more of an objective fact something can be than somebody died from a hurricane or from a natural disaster. So I'm just curious to see how he's going to handle that when it actually.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
It's Trump country.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the reasons that I focus on things like this, I know some people get annoyed by it, so I apologize for that. But one of the reasons I focus on it is there are still people out there who, either by kind of sticking their fingers in their ears or their head in the ground, are trying to convince themselves that things are still the same as they've always been. Things were always bad. It doesn't matter if people say they're worse. It doesn't matter if 3,000 people died this time and 1,500 died last time. It's still fundamentally the same thing. So really don't worry about anything. If the president is disputing his own government's numbers for natural disaster deaths, that is actually new. Things are worse in some fundamental ways. So in effect, Donald Trump has done two things. People tend to focus on one or the other. So he has both taken the lid off of the awfulness and corruption and immorality of our government. That is true. It is more obvious under him. It is also true that it is more corrupt, more immoral, more awful. Both of those things are true at the same time. And for us to properly fight back against what's happening, we need to be able to acknowledge that.
Right. And I just don't understand how he's going to, I mean, there's going to be people that are going to be have to deal with re-election and the way that natural disasters are handled. Also, I believe that, I can't remember which of the Carolinas it was, but there's been an active tussle in the state legislature there over the last couple of years fighting against, you know, there are people in the body trying to pass measures that will put aside money for emergency funds for disaster relief and for just disaster preparedness. Yeah. Can't have it. Why?
And one of them also passed a bill, I think, 6 years ago saying that we are not allowed to use climate science for anything having to do with sea level rise, which obviously influences storm surges and disasters like hurricanes.
But I don't know how much more.
Ignore the science.
Yeah, I don't know how much more direct democracy can get than like your representatives literally want you to drown. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, at the end of the day,
work for them.
You can support or not support a politician for many reasons, but it should really be at the top of the list their willingness to let you die. If they don't care about the continuation of your life, don't donate to their campaigns. Don't organize for them. Don't knock on doors if they won't literally save you from death. Anyway, okay.
They just want to put us in a hobbit home, so you know, I'd rather die. And live in a smaller home.
As long as it's not near the coast, that might be an improvement. Probably more insulation, better energy efficiency in hobbit homes. Okay, we're going to go to our first break. But when we come back, David Sirota is going to be joining us, breaking down one of his recent articles in The Guardian having to do with the battle in these primaries that we've been experiencing, which sort of climax tonight, actually, with New York State primary. The primaries where progressive challengers are going against more established incumbent corporate Democrats. We'll be talking about that after this. It's been a long road through these primaries, but we've still got one left. That's tonight, New York, potentially one of the most significant with some of the highest profile races and extremely consequential races there, especially in the case of Andrew Cuomo versus Cynthia Nixon. Depending on who wins, that is a massive direction shift for New York that could send reverberations throughout the country. Joining us now to break down these primaries and the fight over the future of the Democratic Party is David Sirota, a journalist at Capital in Maine and columnist for The Guardian as well. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So I have a lot that I want to talk to you about, but I was given a prop at the beginning, and I just want to see your response, because I know you're very interested not just in the different sorts of politicians we have, the more establishment corporate, you know, Democrats, progressive challengers, but also how the media approaches those things. Had you seen this Time cover, The Persistence of Nancy Pelosi?
I have seen it, yes.
What did you think of that?
Well, you know, Nancy Pelosi has been around for a long time. Nancy Pelosi didn't leave her position when the Democrats lost the House. And so I guess in a sense, in a literal sense, that is persistence. The question for the Democrats is after you lose epically the elections that they lost and lost the House, why are the same leaders basically running the show for the Democrats in the House? And in my Guardian column, I talk a little bit about how Nancy Pelosi, even now, is setting the parameters for how the Democrats will behave should they win back the majority. She's saying that single-payer Medicare for all shouldn't be a litmus test for the party's candidates. She's also saying essentially that budget austerity measures, budget cutting, will govern the way Democrats put forward policy. Not exactly progressive, or really, I would say, in inspiring messages from the House Democratic leader on the eve of the of what people are calling the most important midterm elections in a long time.
And it really feels to me like just the latest perfect example of the pattern we've had several times in our country, where a Republican gets into office, passes massive tax cuts, requiring budget, you know, priorities to be shifted. So then the Democrat wins because of frustration over the tax cuts, and then they do the work of cutting progressive priorities and not pushing for things that people actually support. So that's frustrating, although I guess not new in America.
It's almost like the fix is in, right? And yeah. And to be frank, I think the fix is in. What we see from our politics right now is essentially a consensus. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about polarization. Oh, the parties are so far apart. But in fact, when you look at policies, many of the policies that the government is dealing with, there is a bipartisan consensus. And we see a bipartisan consensus around budget austerity, cutting social programs. You know, the government supposedly can't be too big. But of course, that principle, both parties believe in policy and in their votes, doesn't seem to apply to the Pentagon or to endless war. Yeah. And so the question now is, you know, are we at a moment where the public is so sick of that consensus that the public is going to start electing people who really explicitly challenge that consensus?
Shavala?
Hi, David. It's Shavala. By all kind of punditry, by all accounts of punditry, the House is looking to flip, but you know the question is by how much. Isn't that going to reinforce the fix that you were just talking about? You know, everybody's fear is kind of this will not embolden the progressive wing of the party. It will embolden. It will just have like two steps forward, like three steps back.
Well, I don't necessarily think so because of this. I think if the Democrats take back the House, there are going to be a group of progressive Democrats, some of them who've been there for a while, others who are poised to win elections after winning tough primaries, who can, in the majority, challenge their own party. I mean, you will have a voting bloc of Democrats in the House, newly elected, with more senior progressive members from the Progressive Caucus, who I think will be in a position to really exert their power. Now, the big question will be, after the election, will they actually go forward and do that? And that, I think, is a question about those specific members of Congress, but it's also that deeper question of whether the public that has been engaged in this election will continue to be engaged after the election. We have seen so many times in the past, especially on the Democratic side, where Democratic politicians will get elected and then the voting wave that elected them into office isn't at their throats, holding their feet to the fire all the time on a day-to-day basis. We most, I think, saw that explicitly in 2008. Obama wins with this huge mandate, and then there was sort of an attitude of, you know, the Democrats in Congress will now fix everything, and we don't necessarily have to keep the pressure on. And what ended up happening out of that was there was a health care bill that was passed with no public option, and single payer was basically off the table. You had a stimulus package that wasn't nearly big enough to adequately do what many people thought it needed to do. You had weak financial regulations. And I think the point there is that you can't just rely on casting a vote and then walking away and hoping that the good people you cast a vote for are going to ultimately execute on the good things that they promised. There's a big gap between the promises and the actual delivery.
So I know that a good amount of your work and your focus recently has been on New York politics. New York is a particularly corrupt, weird, old school version of Democratic politics in terms of the machine they've set up there. So tonight we've got several big races, obviously Cynthia Nixon versus Andrew Cuomo, but there's also Jumaane Williams and Zephyr Teachout. In a larger view, in the primaries that we've had, how significant would you rate these particular primaries? And if Cynthia Nixon, if Zephyr Teachout were able to win, how big of a reaction do you think that would send throughout the media and the rest of the country?
Well, look, the primary contests in New York are hugely important, and they're hugely important for a lot of reasons. One, New York is just a giant state with a huge economy, so policies that pass in New York can have national and international ramifications. If New York became the first state to have single payer, first of all, it's positioned to be able to actually do that. It's got the financial wherewithal to do that. And secondly, it would create a national model, and it could do all sorts of things that much smaller states couldn't do. So the elections, statewide elections in New York, are inherently important. particularly at the attorney general level, because the attorney general is the attorney general that oversees Wall Street and is empowered to investigate Wall Street. And Donald Trump's empire is based in New York. So the attorney general there is also empowered to investigate the shenanigans around the Trump corporate empire. The problem in New York, or at least one of the problems, is that it's very hard for insurgent progressive candidates to win because the system is rigged in a way that's not necessarily even rigged in other states. I mean, we have a generally rigged political system in the United States, and in New York, it's like the worst of the worst. It's very difficult to register to vote, to switch your registration to vote. You have to do it months beforehand, before an election. There are questions about whether there are enough polling stations. There are reports about polling stations not being open until 12 noon. Meanwhile, you have to raise an absolutely enormous amount of money to campaign around that state because it's such a large state. You have LLC loopholes that allow LLCs to funnel money to corporate candidates in ways that they're not necessarily able to do in other states. So the primaries are really important. The attorney general primary with Zephyr Teachout, that is a hugely important primary. The governorship, I mean, all of these primaries are big. But I think the point I'm making here is that let's really understand how much of an uphill climb it is against the entrenched Democratic machine. I think there's a good chance that some of these insurgent candidates can win, but I don't think we should look at if they don't win. You can't look at it and say, you know, oh, this is a complete failure for the progressive movement. I mean, this is an enormously uphill battle. The fact that these are even close contests in the polls is already an amazing achievement, I think.
David, in the piece you talk about how one of the big drumbeats of the progressive candidates and progressive wing of the party is single payer. And for the more establishment ones, the narrative is, listen, we built Obamacare and the Republicans just need to stop messing with it. And that is a false narrative. And can you just kind of talk through that? Because I think for a lot of people that aren't living inside and following, you know, the horse race so in such a detailed way, it feels like the second act of a battle that's already completely convoluted.
Right. So, Obamacare passed. The Obama administration helped kill the public option. The single payer, by the administration's own admission, was effectively omitted from the entire policy debate back then. And what we've seen is that there have been incremental improvements to the healthcare system in the sense of making sure people can't be thrown off of their private insurance if they have a pre-existing condition. This was basically modest private insurance reform, if you're being really honest about Obamacare, and there was an expansion of Medicaid. These are important things, but these are incremental things. And I think that what has happened is that over the last 10 years, people have the American public has realized that, yes, we support those incremental reforms because they're the barest minimum kinds of things that should be done in a humane society. But the healthcare crisis has continued, skyrocketing premiums. You still have insurance companies at the center of the healthcare delivery system, in between patients and their doctors. Look, and so what's gone on is that you've now seen polls showing a huge increase in support for Medicare for All, and that's not surprising. People who are on Medicare, as the surveys show, are much more happy with their health care than people who don't get Medicare. That's not surprising. The Medicare system is not perfect, but it is a guaranteed system. It has lower cost of doing business, administrative costs. So it's not surprising that now you see polls where the public is saying, we support this idea. And even Barack Obama recently gave a speech saying he thinks Medicare for All is now a good idea. Now, he's characterized it as a new idea, I think, because he doesn't want to acknowledge the fact that it's an old idea that he one time as a candidate used to support. He used to support single payer, but it doesn't really, you know, you can go back and nail him for that. But I think the point is that the public has shifted. Now, the question is whether blue states in particular, but everywhere in general, whether they're going to elect Democrats who are serious about legislating single payer and or Medicare for All, that kind of system, or whether those Democrats are going to continue legislating health care policies that appease the donor class, appease the private insurance industry, the drug industry, the hospital industry, all of the industries that are invested in the current system. And so I think when we get to this election, are there going to be enough Democrats who get elected campaigning for Medicare for All, and then who deliver on those campaign promises. And watching that gap, you know, that old saying, mind the gap. Mind the gap between the promises and the actions once these people get into office.
Yeah. Well, hopefully with the new Medicare for All caucus and a larger, certainly larger, hopefully much larger progressive caucus, we might actually see that. Well, David Sirota, a journalist for Capital Maine, thank you so much for joining us, especially on the eve of these incredibly important primaries.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick break, come back, much more to talk about. Back on the Damage Report, John Arola, Shivala Madlina. I didn't really get a chance to say hi to you. Glad to have you here. You're in town doing some work, coordinating with a couple of different international projects at the same time.
Well, I'm a freelancer, so I get to work from where I want to work from some of the time. And if the choice is between London and here now, I mean, I'm going to stay here for a little bit longer.
Yeah, and I'm only going to say this because I know that it makes her really uncomfortable, but you've done work in the Arctic, various parts of Africa, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan?
Have you been not Afghanistan? Syria, and not, Syria? Not Afghanistan yet.
Okay, obviously in Israel. You've done work on North Korea. Done a lot of different work.
We worked on a doc in North Korea.
Exactly.
Can I tell you about that? Yeah.
Yeah, you've worked all over the place.
Some stuff.
Okay, well, there's another situation going on with international ramifications. We've been talking for months now about the ongoing crisis at our border. And by crisis, I mean a man-made crisis. Doesn't need to exist. It's not Hurricane Florence. This is something that our government has chosen to do and to continue. And unfortunately, despite a huge amount of national and media attention on this story a few months back, now not quite as much. But thankfully, the New York Times continuing to do reporting on what's going down at the border. And so we now know that the number of children being detained generally at the border, although in some facilities around the country, is now at record highs. Population levels at federally contracted shelters for migrant children have gone up fivefold since the summer, since last summer, reaching a total of 12,800. So this is not the same exact thing as the separations that were happening earlier, obviously, but the numbers are far, far higher. To put it in context, in May of last year, there were 2,400 kids in that situation. So a fivefold increase, despite the fact that Donald Trump and, you know, Stephen Miller and all of the xenophobic anti-immigrant people say that all of the terrible things they've done have been to dissuade people from coming across the border. So those numbers should be going down. But instead, they have skyrocketed up. And apparently, one of the reasons is that relatives and family friends of the children that are coming across unaccompanied are now so terrified of what could happen to them if they come forward to claim these kids that they're not. So they are staying forcibly separated effectively by government policy from their kids. The kids are going to be staying in these facilities for God knows how long as the number continues to go up.
Yeah, so just to break it down further, this the article in the Times was based on leaked documents that somebody in the House had shared with a reporter there. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't tell exactly why the process for it. So it's the same problem that we've been grappling with for however many years now, of mostly Central American teenagers fleeing like excessive and horrendous amounts of gang violence.
Yeah.
It's so weird that they don't like read Stephen Miller's like policy tweets and then think, you know what, actually, I can cook meth. It's cool. Like, it's fine. But yeah, so that's, that problem has grown exponentially because the process by which they are then like rehomed. So what happens when an unaccompanied child comes into America is they don't get put in a detention center like we do with the adults, keep them in a cage because they're claiming asylum, criminals. We, you know, basically put them in a system that's akin to the foster care system. But with this, for some reason, and I usually, there's a significant chunk of those where like a family member or a relative or a friend of the family has been prearranged ahead of time to like liaise with them at some point once they've put their asylum claim in. And yes, the fear factor is there, which I think is holding up why some of these kids aren't being homed, being put into homes. But I also think that there's just generally like a second guessing of like every single step in the process, and it's a complete mess. And it's just, it's the, what happened during the summer threw everything into chaos. And these are children that are like, what did you do in your eighth grade summer? Oh, I spent my time in a cage or in a tent. And that some of them are in tents, and it reminds
literal
me
tent cities.
Yeah, it just reminds me of the tent cities you see in Jordan with the refugees there. And listen, that's We're paying exponentially for those as well.
Yeah, crazy amount. Every time one of these stories comes out, there's more information about the expansion of these tent cities, how they're expecting we're going to need more. Because some of these facilities apparently last year were at like 30% capacity.
Yeah.
Now they're at in the 90s. But I haven't seen anything from the government that indicates that they're going to be changing their policy to make it less likely that they'll be holding more of these kids in for longer. So what's in the 90s after 1 year of this policy, God only knows what it'll be at next year. And by the way, when they feel the emergency need to put the kids elsewhere, do you believe that the standards they will apply to the facilities in the future will be stringent? I don't think so. What about the people who are going to be managing these kids? Are they going to be carefully watching what sorts of people these are?
Well, one of
that
the,
already hasn't been happening before the major emergency happens.
Yeah, well, one of the kind of side effects of the outcry over the child separations was, I guess, semi-beneficial in that there was like much higher scrutiny on scandals that were happening at these facilities, which, of course, it's just a numbers game. I'm sorry, but if you have thousands and thousands of teenagers and kids and also people who aren't necessarily trained to be around children, some of them have just had like a background check.
Yeah.
There were incidents of molestation, of assault, of
forced medication.
They're not child. I know they're not your kids, and I know that they're brown kids, but I don't think. Do you want to hurt them all the time? Like, mm-hmm. Do we want to pay through the
Probably
nose
not our listeners.
To hurt them all the time? Yeah. I don't know who I'm talking to. Invisible crazy person.
Not you. She's talking to the president. He's invisible and crazy. Yes. So again, 12,800 kids. We knew it was an emergency earlier this year. Some people might believe that things have become better, but no, they're quite literally five times worse. So just bear that in mind as we move towards these midterms. And again, just to really ram home that things are only as bad as they've ever been. No, they're at least five times worse in one easily identifiable metric.
Oh, sorry. One last thing on that is that it's being spun as like, see, we need to fix our broken system. And it's just,
We do need to fix our broken system, but this is not fixing it. This is breaking it in all new ways that we hadn't previously known about.
I know.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Lots more to get to when we come back on the other side. So earlier this week, we were lucky enough to be joined on the show by Karan Blair of the Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools to break down some really fascinating research having to do with the massive budgetary shortfalls as if it's an accident. It was intentional. Low-income students have been effectively robbed of $580 billion, I believe it was. But now I want to talk a little bit more about what we can do about it and also what teachers across the country have been doing about it. And so we're lucky to be joined right now by Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, to talk about this. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's great to have you here. So, in that intro, I was alluding to that new report showing $580 billion. How did you react to this finding?
I was stunned that it was that much. I expected it to be high because this is $580 billion from 2005 to 2017. So essentially, we have two laws. For your viewers/listeners, and thank you for covering this. There's two laws that say that were passed in one in the 60s and one in the 70s that basically say every single young person who has special needs is entitled to a specific education program. And it was always promised to be funded by the federal government to the tune of 40%. It was never funded more than about 10%. And the second thing is Title I, which Johnson passed, and that was every single poor kid in the United States of America should have a level playing field. And when you add up the deprivation, that it was $580 billion. And what that means is that kids don't get guidance counselors. They don't get AP courses. It's not simply all the stories we're not seeing, like the cover of Time magazine, which says, I have a master's degree. I've taught for 16 years, and I have to sell plasma to actually earn a living because my teacher salary doesn't earn me enough. This is a matter of kids who go to more wealthy schools in high tax or more wealthy areas, because mostly schools are funded by property taxes, they get this stuff and everybody else doesn't. And that is how we are hurting, undermining our promise to the next generation that we are going to help them on the ladder of success.
So I want to talk a little bit about, obviously this has been boiling over for a long time. The study talks about basically like a 15-year period, but the funding has never been there, going back literally decades. And so this year we've actually seen a lot of teachers apparently responding to the fact that they don't have resources for these programs. Their wages are so low in a number of states. And so there have been state-level walkouts in a number of different states. How would you rate the success of those walkouts in achieving the teachers' goals?
Well, they are step one in terms of achieving goals. At the end of the day, you have to change policy and you have to change some of these formulas. There are 10 active lawsuits that are challenging these funding formulas state after state after state. But what has happened, the reason that people are so focused on the last 10 years is because the recession and its aftermath has been used by the right wing as a way of cutting even more. That's why you saw the strikes in Oklahoma, in West Virginia, in Kentucky, in Arizona, because these are places where that other than that human shield, that walkout action, which was supported by the public, you basically had us and teachers for the last 10 years knocking on the doors of legislators and saying, you have to help us. Yes, we're always going to take money out of our pockets to help kids, but we can't fund guidance counselors for schools. We can't fund nurses out of our salaries for schools. We can't fund AP courses. We can't fund lower class sizes. And we actually can't live on our salaries anymore. We can't, so many teachers work 2 and 3 jobs. And so you saw that human shield that created the knowledge and the outrage. But unless we change who is in office, then the policies don't change.
Randy, it's Shabala. You just talked about those 10 active lawsuits. Can you maybe kind of talk through some of the more significant ones and what they kind of illustrate about where the rubber's meeting the road on this? Even just the framing of how you're describing this, it's uniquely American. Like, there's austerity measures that politicians are talking about. Therefore, we take money away from funding our schools and children who are the neediest. And also that the pushback is, well, we need to cut funding somewhere. Well, we're teachers and we can't work 3 jobs and fund all these extra things, and we shouldn't have to, is the other like missing beat. Can you kind of talk through those lawsuits and like kind of what they're gonna, where the rubber is gonna meet the road on those?
Right. And you know, so look, I'm a social studies teacher. I start with facts. So take Detroit. There's a suit right now to sue for the right for literacy, that there needs to be enough resources from the state of Michigan to ensure that every single child has the opportunity to be literate. Because you need to read to learn. You need to learn to read by 3rd grade, and then you read to learn. So that's one of the lawsuits that's there. And of course, the middle courts in the state of Michigan denied that. We often have to go to the highest courts. There are lawsuits about the conditions of schools. Take what's happened in Baltimore, where there was not enough heat in the winter and there's no air conditioning in the summer, so schools were closed. There's lawsuits about funding formulas, like in New York, where we see that the formulas disproportionately are unequal, meaning the kids that need the most get the least, just like what we see now in the Title I funding. So, and virtually every state has had a case like that. In New Jersey, it was called Abbott. In New York, it was called the Campaign for Fiscal Equity. In Detroit, it's called something else. It's normally called by a plaintiff who has actually brought this suit. But take what Betsy DeVos did 2 years ago. She cut every single summer school program, every single after-school program. So you tell me, when there could be a $1 trillion to $2 trillion tax cut for the wealthy, And at the same time, a person like Betsy DeVos is cutting $9 billion. That is a matter of priority. That is, to use her word, a matter of choices. And their choice is to disrupt, undermining, defund, decimate public education so that parents are forced to find private alternatives. So it is a venal choice, this austerity combined with privatization. And thank God, people are finally getting it and saying, wait a second, this is not right. But it requires people to vote for people in office that are going to make public education and our kids a priority.
And thankfully, in less than 2 months now, they might have that choice. Randy Weingarten of the American Federation of Teachers, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. One more break for you. Lots more we're going to try to fit in just a few minutes after this. So we usually like to finish the show with a little bit of fun. So let's turn to methane deregulation. The Environmental Protection Agency is expected perhaps even this week to make public a proposal to weaken an Obama-era requirement that companies monitor and repair methane leaks. So this fits very much into the climate strategy of Donald Trump and the EPA over the course of the past year and a half, where the incremental gains made at hard cost over 8 years of Obama's presidency have been stripped away one after the other. They've been working on this one for quite a while, actually. And so, by the way, and not just this. So the EPA is working, also Department of Interior, which plans to repeal a restriction on the intentional venting and flaring or burning of methane from drilling operations. So again, this is intentional, by the way. So you have the intentional emission and burning of methane. You have the regulations Obama put in place to try to limit how much leaking of methane is going on. And to give you an idea of how much you should care about the continuation of these regulations, Kathleen Sagama, president of the Western Energy Alliance, said, it's a neat pair of proposals on methane. Before, it was a record-keeping nightmare to not leak methane all over the place. And the reason we care for this is because although methane makes up only about 9% of greenhouse gases, it is between 25 and I've seen 83 times more effective than carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the atmosphere. And we're about to intentionally and accidentally emit more of it.
Yeah, like this is one of the, if you believe that the planet is warming, this is one of the key things you should care about.
Don't say if you believe.
I know.
You're one of those.
I keep talking to these invisible crazy people. I don't know why I keep doing that. But it's just like, I always start at the base fact. And it's like, this is just a base fact. Come on. Mm-hmm. So with that quote from Kathleen Sagama or whatever her name was, she's like the head of the Western Energy Alliance or something, which sounds
Association
like
of Independent Oil and Gas Companies.
Yes. That made me think the way she was talking. It was a red tape nightmare in the field and really hard to implement. Record-keeping nightmare. I'm like, so you weren't even doing it? That's what it sounded like. And I'm sure there's a lot of rough estimating out in the field. So there's already that. And then I believe her quote after that was, it's just about the administration. The last administration believed environmentalists. This administration believes industry. That did not help your cause in any way, Kathleen, however you pronounce your last name.
Sagama. Her last name has been affected by too much methane.
It melted.
This is not about belief. It's not like that there are two competing studies. Methane's bad for the environment. Methane's actually great. Tastes amazing, low calories. It's not like that. It's methane's terrible for the environment and shut up, I want money. That's all it is. And I guess the government believes the money argument a little bit more. But it's not like new findings have shown that methane is actually not that bad or we were leaking less of it than we actually thought. Those base level facts, as you were alluding to, are just as true now as they were under Barack Obama. We just don't care. We are willing to set the country and the planet on fire to perhaps incrementally for a short period of time increase corporate profits for the Western Energy Alliance and other independent oil and gas companies.
Yeah, so the people who would say, okay, I do, like the spokesperson, I don't know how you can be a thinking, intelligent, educated person and sleep at night and be working to push industry priorities ahead of just clean air and people not dying and getting sick. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you want to take that, if you want to take making money over burning the planet down, making literally causing actual deaths per year, what is it going to take? What is it going to actually take? Yeah. Why don't we just go full, like, whole hog? Like, what would be her whole thing of, like, this administration believes industry? What do you mean believes industry? Mm-hmm. There's no, like, there's no competing narrative. Your narrative is just, you're not there to set the tone, set the environmental standards. Yeah, yeah.
It has more funding.
You don't know about the environment.
Like, well, unfortunately, I wish we had more time. We do have to cut out. Thank you, Shivala, as always, for coming in. It was great to have you on these last two times. Thank you for watching. We'll be back tomorrow with just one more show for you this week. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.